This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 29th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. On this week's show, we're donning our comfortable shoes and saddling up to hit three design trade fairs in three cities. We meet and greet the big players and the young guns and lust over plenty of new furniture. We'll also be talking business too. At IMM in Cologne, I sit down with one lovely lady who's keeping furniture in the family.
I reopened the old woodshop of my grandfather. My family has always been working together, and it's really the way we work. And my mom is doing all the customer stuff. My dad is still working with me. My brother is doing quality and product and material.
Over in Paris at Maisonette Objet, we discover a canny young Japanese ceramicist breathing life into British pottery production. And at the Interior Design Show in Toronto, we hear how the Canadian city has ambitions to carve a niche for itself on the global design circuit.
We're not trying to be New York. You know, we don't want to be ICFF. You know, we're not trying to be Milan. You know, that's a whole other... I think it's sort of that unapologetic approach to we're Canadian, and what does that mean?
That's all to come and much, much more over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's Section D in the German city of Cologne. Every January, the design industry flocks to Cologne for the first trade fair of the year, IMM. The small city teems, hotel rooms are as rare as hen's teeth, and the mood is buoyant. A new year means a clean slate. And the German market is booming. While many of the southern European design fairs are shrinking, together with their economies and domestic spend, it's a different story in Germany. It's no surprise then that everyone wants a piece of the action, and foreign exhibitors were higher this year than ever before. The fairgrounds for IMM were heaving. The queues at the Frankfurter kiosks come lunch were almost unbearable. But in amongst the throngs, I whizzed around and garnered the opinions of some designers, makers and manufacturers who gave me their take on proceedings. First up, Stephanie Herring, owner and founder of the exquisite and expanding German porcelain brand Herring Berlin.
We are a porcelain manufacturer, and our range of products at the moment includes porcelain, glass, lighting and textiles, and some of cast iron. And our thing is, our idea is to reconstruct the tableware for dining in the 21st century. We take care of the craftsmanship. We believe in craftsmanship, and we produce most of our work in Germany and the textiles in Switzerland.
Germany has a long history of porcelain craftsmanship, but why did you decide to launch a new brand? And where did the idea come from?
The idea actually is, I respect very much the manufacturers, the German porcelain manufacturers. But as a young person, 20 years ago, I couldn't find something in their collection where I thought I would like to live with every day. But I like very much the quality of a handcrafted work. So I thought, well, there is a need. Nobody takes care, not just the industrial designed items for machine production, mass production, but I want to have it smaller, personally, more emotional product. So I thought, nobody takes care about that, so I have to do that.
And how difficult was it to start a brand like this from scratch?
Well, I gave myself at the beginning 1 year and to see if the market likes what I'm doing and to see if I can make a living out of it. I started with one square meter on the trade fair in Frankfurt, and I immediately had the success. Also coming from the industrial guys saying, oh, we like your work, could you design for us? So that's, I noticed, okay, people like the touch of what we do, because what I do is I love porcelain, but I love the material, how it is on its own, because it's white earth and it's absolutely, in the past we said it's a white gold. Yeah? And so our idea was just to work with the clay and with structures, but with no color. Take care about shapes and function and all this to get a touch here. Yeah?
Today, how many people do you employ?
In Berlin, in the office, we are 13 people, and in production in Thuringen, where we produce the porcelain, there we produce together with 50 people. Theresienthal, the mouse blowing glass company, they produce, I think, at the moment, around about 20 people.
Your customer base is mainly in Germany, or is it all over the world now?
No, it's all over the world. Because of the whiteness of the range, we do lightings, we do all these tableware things. We have the gastronomy, we have hotels, because our work is beautiful but also functional. We do private houses, we do yards, we do boats, we do all sorts of things. So we meet a lot of interesting people, but from all over the world. Yeah. And it starts, actually, the best clients are the students when they come and buy their first item, and then they collect, and when they're old enough, they have a full range.
And you mentioned before the fact that you started with porcelain, but today on your stand you have glassware, lighting and textiles as well. Is the idea to create an entire Herring Berlin environment where you can come and get everything that you need for your tableware?
Yeah, the focus is, of course, on the table. We take care of the essence of fine dining. And also what we take care of the materials. When we work with porcelain, we think about this clay and how does this clay react in fire and what kind of shapes do come out. And the same thing we do with the glass and we do with cotton and all materials who come up or are interesting at the moment for us to work with. So it's always the combination of a good design and the soul of the material to bring these together.
So the only thing when I'm looking at your stand that's missing from the table is cutlery. Is that next?
Yes, and we need more money for this, you know. No, it's coming. It's already designed, so don't worry. Once upon a time, it will come up.
And finally, how important is a trade fair like Cologne for you in terms of gathering new business? Do you feel that it's still the best way of connecting with new customers and new markets?
Yeah, it's one way of connecting, meeting new clients, new markets. In Cologne, I mean, people who are interested in furnitures, in kitchens, are also interested in what do they put in their cupboards, what do they put on their table. So here, for us, it's an interesting meeting, what we get, interesting talks, and of course, orders, contacts, and it's one of, we do interior shows, we do also cooking kitchen shows for chefs, and we do shows like Maison et Objet for interior design items, not for furniture. So it's always a combination. We meet a lot of people, and that's a good thing.
That was Stephanie Herring, founder and owner of Herring Berlin, there at IMM Cologne. And further down the aisles, I spotted a familiar, friendly face. Geza Hansen is the driving force behind a beautiful young furniture brand called the Hansen Family. Half Danish, half German, the Hansen family's furniture collection owes much to both design heritages. Everything is made in a small atelier in Sauerland, but such is the appeal of the pieces and the company's story, recent collaborators have included Kitsune and Surface to Air. Here's Geza to tell us more.
I was allowed by my father, who is Hans Hansen, to exhibit the table, and nobody was sure of it. Everybody looked at me kind of like, what is this doing? And you were the first person who was coming to the booth and saw it. So it was the first time that somebody said, oh, this is interesting. And then the whole success came afterwards, but there was really the first moment.
Good, so it was all thanks to me.
Yes, it was all thanks to you.
No, but not
it was,
at all.
I was, it was Monaco who exposed it first time.
Good.
No, it was, yeah, it was Monaco afterwards.
I think it could well have been, because I moved to Monaco quite shortly after that. Today, though, you have many pieces here, and an entire sort of brand that has grown out of just that one table that you showed, called Atelier of the Hansen Family. Hans Hansen, as you said, is your father.
Yeah.
But this is a family operation.
I decided to call it Ateliers of the Hansen Family because I reopened the old woodshop of my grandfather, because my dad is really a minimalistic designer. And I reopened the old woodshop. And my family has always been working together, and it's really the way we work. And my mom is doing all the customer stuff. My dad is still working with me. My brother is doing quality and product and material. And I didn't want it to call Gesa Hansen, like kind of like my dad did, because I wanted to create a label where I could work with other designers as well, and to have this idea to only say, okay, become part of the family, and to be able to be an editor as well.
And everything is made in Germany?
Yes, it's like it's made in the wood shop, and now the wife of my brother is doing wood as well, so her dad is in wood as well. So it's even a bigger family of wood, and they start doing some products as well.
So nice. So how important is the made in Germany element of the brand for you?
For me, it's really important. It's much easier as well, because you can really work on the products. You don't have a communication problem. Mm. And you can, it's really you who decides how the prototypes will be. But Virginia is from Lithuania, the wife of my brother. And with her, I can also discuss, but I really have to do the prototypes on my own, because I don't draw in 3D design programs, because I always feel limited. And I feel like the program is deciding for me, not me. And when I work on the woods with my hands, I really feel like it's me who's deciding.
And that would then make sense, because looking at the products that you design, they have a very sort of human element to them. And also very Scandinavian, which presumably comes from your heritage as well.
Yeah, that is just how I grew up, and with all the pieces. And I'm really inspired by the work of my grandfather. And it's funny, because my dad was inspired by the work of his great-grandfather. And I just feel like it always has to skip a generation. You cannot do what your father does, but you can be inspired by the generation before.
And how are the products selling? Do you sell them directly, or do you have them stocked in various sort of showrooms around the world?
I have, in every country I chose one small gallery, because actually I figured that they sell much more than big stores. So in France I'm sold by Centoux. They're doing an enormous job. I don't know how they do it. They sell really good. And in New York I'm sold by Matters. And so it's always small companies, but who really are in love with their products. And I think that's like we work in our brand as well, and so it matches much more, much better than if they would be in a large furniture store.
That was Gesa Hansen from the Hansen family there, quite possibly my new favourite design company. Another familiar face and flag flyer for the next generation of German design is Sebastian Hoechner. At a time when young designers and graduates are finding it more difficult than ever to break into the industry and see their designs go into production, everyone wants a piece of Hoechner and his work. Though the immaculately mannered German insists he won't be joining the celebrity design gang anytime soon.
We present now the bell table here in 2003 colours. And then at the design post, there's my new project with Moroso, an armchair code. We are just working on the sofa version for Milan Fair in a few months. And then there's a small side table made of turned wood. For German manufacturer Böwe. And the idea behind this was, it was to do something with turned wood. And I was thinking about the material, the process. I visited one of these craftsmen, and it's so interesting how they glue the wooden pieces together, then they turn it, and also the structure. So it was not my aim to have it very slim and soft. I wanted to show the trails and the structure of the wood, because this is very important to show also that it's handcrafted. And the idea is to have a small side table, and there's a metal plate like a tray on top, and you can open it more or less like turning the record with DJ. And then there's a small mini bar inside, so hidden like in a James Bond movie maybe. You sit on your armchair and you can open it and smoke a cigarette and have your gin inside.
Very nice indeed. You are probably one of Germany's most exciting young designers. How difficult is it to
breakthrough from just being, say, a graduate showing prototypes to actually having direct contact with manufacturers and making them aware of what you're doing and interested to put these prototypes into production?
Yeah, it's a crazy time now, just launched with Moroso and Classicon, and now of course you're getting in contact with great companies, and for me it's very important to meet the company first, to see the history and their aim and the material and how they work. And that's incredible when you go to Udine, where Moroso is based, and it's such a family business with nice history and all these people working together, and that makes very fun. And then you be in contact with them. It was the same with Patrizio Moroso. And then you talk about different things, and then you talk about maybe concept, a collaboration. Then it was in London 2011 at the London Design Week. Then there I met Patrizia for breakfast, and I presented her the concept of this armchair, and it was a baby socks with this anti-slippery print, and then a very rough model, just cardboard and some fabric, and it was not a perfect done, not proportioned, just to tell the story, and this is very important. And she fell in love with the story, and then actually it was in September, we started with the final design, with the shapes, with the details. But at the beginning, it's very important to be in contact with them, to feel comfortable with them, and that they also have the same philosophy and the same kind of working, and then to start this whole process, and then it's always a together.
People say though that today more than ever the bigger manufacturers are too scared to work with new designers and younger names because it's a bit of a risk that people who will be buying this furniture won't recognize the name of the designer, and they want to buy something that might be an investment piece designed by a big name. But your experience would sort of prove maybe that that's not the case so much, or do you think maybe you've just been lucky?
Yeah, for example, with the bell table runs very well for Classicon, and it's a piece you can find now in stores and concept stores around the world. And they have pieces they just sell maybe in France, but not in Germany. But this table works everywhere. And I don't know if the people buying this table know me, but it's, if you fell in love with something which is very authentic and also classic in a way, and it works together with different styles, interior styles, then it's a personal thing.
So you think the strength of the design itself is what speaks rather than the person who designs it?
Yeah, of course, also the designer is important behind, but I don't want to be in front of my furniture. They don't have to be in my shadow. They have to be on the stage, not me.
That was Sebastian Hoechner there, the young German designer whose star is very definitely in the ascendant. And as the sun set on Cologne, everyone agreed that Germany's biggest furniture trade fair, once considered the slightly dull one on the circuit, is today one of the brightest and best. While Germany's economy continues to expand, so too does its design industry. IMM Cologne might not yet have the star appeal of Milan's Salone, but when so much of the glitz and glamour of design is beginning to look a little hollow, the German fair is the one to hit if you want to hoover up good business. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we're off to Maison et Objet in Paris, where our resident smooth talker, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, went wild in the aisles.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus. Creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, here on Monocle 24. Hot on the heels of IMM Cologne comes Maison et Objet in Paris, a lighter, more refined affair, fittingly for the glorious French capital. If Cologne is about furniture and hard business, Maison et Objet deals with smaller accessories and has a stronger focus on retail. Walking through the busy aisles of stationery, tableware and throw cushions, our section editor Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi bumped into the soft-spoken British-Japanese designer Reiko Kaneko. Kaneko specializes in fine bone china, and although her tableware is designed using 3D modeling programs, for her, the artisan's expertise is always more important than technology. That's why she moved from London to the quiet Stoke-on-Trent.
We started off with giftware, but we're going more into tableware and tabletop pieces for restaurants and hotels, and it's all about the shapes that we're kind of interested in. At the moment, all our pieces are very white, because that's what bone china is famous for, but we're experimenting with colour at the moment, and we hope by September of the shows then we'll have some more vibrant colours in the collection.
Do you design all the pieces yourself, or is there a team that...
Yeah, no, we design most of the things myself, and we work with quite a few restaurants and bars actually to do bespoke pieces, which we're kind of really interested in kind of developing a little bit more, because it's always quite fun to work with their ideas and kind of mesh our style and kind of quality of our pieces with that sort of thing. So
I understand you were based in London before, but now you've moved closer to your producers.
Yeah, I think it's just a lot easier to work with people face to face, and when it's factories, when you know the lead times are shorter, and we figured we're going to take the bull by the horns and just move up there because that's where the history of the bone china is.
And Stoke-on-Trent.
Yeah, Stoke-on-Trent is where it historically started, fine bone china, to compete with the fine porcelain that was coming in from China at the time, Spode and Wedgwood. They were looking into and experimenting with the different porcelains, and because you couldn't get the whiteness or the thin fire, the high fire fineness of the porcelain coming in, they were experimenting with different things and finally came across putting bone ash into the china. So it's Cornish clay and several other things mixed in with bone ash, which gives it that whiteness of the china, and it also strengthens the china. So it's quite famous for not being chip resistant, so it's a really strong but fine material, whereas in those days, back in the day, they could only get quite thick earthenware, and so that's why the whole industry grew around Spode and Wedgwood, was because it was so popular. So it got bigger and bigger, but you know, obviously recently a lot of the manufacturing's moved abroad, but there still is quite a lot of the model makers and, you know, mould makers. There's a whole industry kind of worked around the whole bone china. So it's the place to be, basically, for bone china. It's not the prettiest place, to be honest, but if you want to learn about the material more and work with the people who has that experience, because clay isn't something like plastic where you could just inject and it would be quite easy to kind of develop. If you're doing new shapes, it's predictable, but because it's clay at the end of the day and you're kind of firing it at, you know, 1200 degrees, these bone china pieces, some of the new shapes you're experimenting with, you don't know whether it's going to work out in the kiln or not, whether it's going to collapse. So I'm still learning and we'll see how it all goes.
Well, I'm joined now in the studio by our edits editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, fresh from the halls of Maison et Objet in Paris. Santiago, thank you for coming into the studio.
Hi, Hugo.
Hello. Well, that was a lovely interview with Reiko Kaneko, but I'm guessing she wasn't the only person that you met whilst you were in the trade fairs.
No, definitely not. I bumped into many different designers, some of which were very young, and it was the first time they were exhibiting there. Very, very interesting approach to a new form of design, I think, is very focused on producing something that's very organic, using raw materials, going back to the earth, to the land, to basic products, and creating beautiful, simple products and objects. And one of the companies I bumped into is No Saku. They are based in Takoaka, which is a city known for its copper, and its coppersmiths.
And this is in Japan, is it?
In Japan, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. And this company in particular was founded in 1916. And their expertise in working with metals includes objects made in tin and in brass. And what I really liked are a set of brass animals, very little, very tiny, but perfectly done, very cute. And I think it could decorate any table or maybe a dining table or something.
Very nice indeed.
Those were beautiful.
Maison tends to be about smaller objects, sort of tableware items in particular, and accessories and things. And the Japanese have always made quite a big splash there. But did you notice this year there were more Japanese companies than previous?
Yes, there were a lot. There were a lot of Japanese companies there. The Japanese creative had a big stand as well. And they were showcasing their products, some of which we saw at the Salone del Mobile last year. And they were also doing an activity with confectionery, so using traditional French confectionery techniques to create candy that was very nicely shaped, well designed, almost it looked more like a small architectural maquettes rather than candy. But that was very interesting. I also saw companies from other countries. One was Goikoetxea, well from the Basque country, which is of course, still in France, but they were making a very interesting a lamp made of raw clay. Goikoetxea usually, I've seen their products in the past, and usually they have very shiny pots and
highly glazed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this was a little bit more organic by the
sounds
of things.
Yes, totally. They were designed by Jean-Louis Razzocchi. Mm. And he created this, maybe a bit too heavy to make a lamp out of clay, but it was very, very nicely shaped, and it had that nice feel to it. Mm-hmm. So I think that was also
one highlight of, theme.
Of the companies that I really liked.
Tell me, with the people in attendance, there's always a lot of press there. But also, given its tableware, it has a huge sort of appeal to the contract market. Did you notice that there were a lot of maybe Chinese buyers who were looking to sort of snap up some...
The Russians.
The Russians, really.
Yeah, it was full of Russians, a lot of Brazilians too. I know Brazil has very tight importing regulations, but they were there and they were interested. One of the problems with this fair and with many other fairs is that sometimes the exhibitors only speak the local language. Mm-hmm. In this case, I bumped into many exhibitors that were fluent in French but didn't really dominate English. And I think that has to change a bit because especially now you need to at least hire an intern or two that speaks Spanish, Portuguese, and Russian.
No, absolutely. It's something that I noticed at Cologne as well, where a lot of the smaller, younger German firms looking to sort of make a splash on the global market just couldn't communicate with the likes of Russians or the Chinese,
exactly.
Particularly.
Yeah, they miss out on big clients there because it was full a lot of leather carry suitcases and you know, like all this blingy people walking around. You could see they were really interested in this new market.
Finally, if you were to take one thing back from the fair to live with yourself, what would it be?
I think the pepper, salt and nutmeg grinders made by Raumgestalt. This German company,
firm.
Yeah, you're probably familiar with them. They had this beautiful set of grinders designed by Alexander Orlieb from Bernau, and what was nice is that the grinder itself or the mill was made by Sassenhaus, which is a company that's been making this sort of grinders since 1867, ceramic grinders. So you can grind your salt or your pepper in from fine powder to coarse grain, however you prefer.
Very nice indeed. And you didn't just come back armed with a load of leaflets and press releases. You've brought a song back from Paris too, haven't you?
I did, yeah. A song that accompanied me during my trip. This is Another Likely Story by Au Revoir Simone, the Aeroplane Remix.
It gets harder, I remember to remember waking up.
That was Another Likely Story by Au Revoir Simon, as chosen by Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi. Thank you, Santiago. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D, and we're off to Toronto for the Interior Design Show to hear about Canada's burgeoning design scene next. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Time to pull on your winter gear as we head to a minus 20 degree winter in Toronto. It's not a city renowned as a vital stopover on the global design circuit, but that's not to say it doesn't have a thriving design community of its own. Last weekend at the Metro Convention Centre, Toronto played host to Canada's leading design fair, the Interior Design Show, which celebrates design from every corner of Canada. And there's much to celebrate, as our reporter Marcella's discovered.
If you walk around the fair, you just see incredible booths, incredible people at the booths, and it's just a really, really wonderful fair.
I think what's nice about the IDS is that there is quite like a local sector as well. Often like other fairs and events just trying to bring in all the international designers and things like that. And I think particularly in Canada, design is quite a young field. It doesn't have the same history as Italy, for example, or just Europe in general. So I think it's a great opportunity for people to come in and see what design can be.
Andrea Chin, managing editor of Milan-based Design Boom. This weekend, I made my way to Toronto's Convention Center for IDS 13, Toronto's Interior Design Show, with over 300 vendors across 4 days and speakers ranging from author Douglas Copeland to architect Jürgen Mayer. It was a busy weekend. One of the interesting exhibits I found was the Design Boom Mart. It was like an indoor street market made up of bright, new, cutting-edge designers flaunting their products. Andrea Chin explains more.
Okay, so our main focus is the designboom.com, which is the online publication. And we also have off-site events, such as the Design Boom Mart, which we're featuring here at the IDS. We host about 3 to 4 Design Boom Marts per year, and this is the first time that we're in Canada at the IDS. The Design Boom Mart started, the first one we ever had was in 2005 at the New York ICFF. And what it is, it's a platform for young designers to present their work in a setting which they might normally not have the opportunity to. For example, at trade fairs, it's quite a large cost for young people to invest in. So what the Design Boom Mart is meant to be, is to be a curated group exhibition. So these designers have been selected by Design Boom to exhibit within this space. And it's an international group of young designers. They're from all over the world. And what we basically want to offer a platform for them is to show their work to the broader public. And so some of them actually only have prototypes. These are opportunities for them to start networking with different manufacturers to possibly get connections on how they can go about further developing their work. And it's also an opportunity for people to buy unique small production items.
How do you make an indoor exhibition in a traditional convention center look like an exciting raw street market?
For this particular edition of the Design Boom Mart, local studio Arc & Co. has specifically designed the exhibition space for our exhibit. And they have done all the branding and everything. And it's consists of wooden frames which have been stacked to create walls, and the tables are a little bit unconventional. They're plastic industrial moving bins. So it's a very kind of raw, rustic space, but it works because when you walk through the space, it's the products that are on show.
Another unique exhibition at the fair was Modern Kid, a focus on design for children, featuring companies from around the world, including French company Gautier, designer of the race car bed. Gautier's Laura McNabb,
And really what's happening in the kids industry right now, or the children's industry, is that it's no longer just mommy and daddy that get to have the designer sort of living room and dining room. It's now moved in, whether it's happening in fashion. We all know there's the celebrity kids that are walking around in Dior and what have you, and now it's moved into the bedroom, where bedrooms, you know, are no longer just pink and blue and things like that, or, you know, boys get this color. And also the design is that now you've got pops of color, you've got, you know, whatever's on trend in home decor is on trend in the kids industry as well. It's not just childlike accessories, it's all sorts of very adult looking. They're using black and white in the spaces, or they're using geometrics or what have you.
Another modern kid exhibitor, Ralph Montemaro from Toronto's Monty Design.
About 8 years ago, my wife and I built a modern home, and we had two children at the time, third on the way, and we were designing the nursery, and there was nothing modern for the nursery. So just started prototyping a few different products, and the glider chair was a missing item for a modern nursery. So we decided to open up a factory to build them in Toronto, Canada. When a parent has a child, the rocking motion is very nice to soothe the baby. So our chairs are gliders and rockers. So when they sit in them, you nurse the baby, and the rocking motion is very, very soothing for a child. The customer is probably somebody who's got a lot of style, who appreciates good design, good quality, and wants a piece that will graduate from the nursery into somewhere in their home, because it doesn't really look like a nursery product.
Covering kids' design and street market design marts, the IDS in its 15th year is Canada's biggest and only real design fair. Kicking off the new year in January, designers and brands from around the world travel to Toronto to show off their collections. Lisa Barnes of IDS.
Basically, there's over 300 different exhibits, and they range from like a 50 by 60 square foot, like a 50 by 60 foot booth, which is just a monster, down to like a 5x5 in the Studio North. So it's got really good energy. It's sprinkled with lounges and bars and like tasting bars. For example, Bark Smokehouse is there. They're serving some amazing smoked meats. Like, you know what I mean? We've got some really cool food partners. So it's an experience. Like, there's stuff on the main stage. There's a couple of different features on the floor. There's a How Do You Work feature, which basically is four different concept spaces that are different designer and design firms takes on sort of their work process.
The How Do You Work exhibit features four distinct designers' unique approach to the current concept of a workspace. Laurie Bedecon of Montreal's Saint Mars Studio.
This is the concept space. Every year there's a different theme. This year it's How Do You Work? And we're part of four other teams that have been selected. So we literally brought our workshop to Toronto. We brought our tools, our actual tools. We brought finished pieces, we brought images, inspiration shots that shows the process of how we get to the final piece and who we work with also. We really went low-tech, old school, and it's who we are. So we brought, let me see, you have the stencils. So the old school stencils, the thicknesses of the pencils, the sharpeners that go with it, the knitting needles that are there.
What about the snowshoes?
Well, the snowshoes actually are part of a collection that we made. So we go and we find old snowshoes that have been abandoned, slightly broken, used, just left to be thrown out, basically. And we refurbish them and we give them a new life and we sell them as decorative objects that you could have on your wall. And that goes with the rest of our collection.
As I got Laurie to describe the Saint Mars Studio design, a clear patriotic Canadian theme emerged.
Okay, well, all of our pieces have a source of inspiration in Canadian culture or Canadian heritage. Either it's craft technique, it's the materials, it's a choice of color, it's a choice of fabric. There's always something based in Canadian roots. So we have our bar stool, which is the Mountie. It's bright red, and it has a little wink to the horse saddle, is a little pommel on top. So you can put a jacket or a bag. We have the curling stone table. where the middle is hollowed out. Yeah, the one in the corner. It's hollowed out. You could pop it open and you could store stuff in it. So it's a little side table, but it could also be used as a bench.
And it's an actual curling stone.
And it's an actual curling stone. And it weighs like an actual curling. It's like 20 pounds to lift it. We have the snowshoes and we have the little footstool, which is made of sheep fur, but which is also available in beaver fur.
The overrunning theme of the IDS event seemed to be one of Canadian pride, a typical trait to many Canadian culture and business endeavors. The proud to be Canadian idea. I asked Lisa Barnes how she thought Canadian design fit into the bigger world stage.
Well, it's amazing because we have that discussion all the time. And one of the things that, you know, I think has changed is, you know, we don't, so for example, from a show perspective, you know, we're not trying to be New York. You know, we don't want to be ICFF. You know, we're not trying to be Milan. You know, that's a whole other, I think it's sort of that unapologetic approach to we're Canadian. And what does that mean? And what does CanCon mean? And what does Canadiana mean? And there's a lot of features on the floor. For example, the lounge that we're sitting in right now is sort of a really fun nod to a celebration of Canadian design. It's like a deconstructed log cabin. We've got maharam cushions that we're sitting on in this really wicked plaid. We've got this wonderful vinyl flooring that's been used as is embossed and used as furniture. It's used on the bars, it's used on the walls. This is a Canadian company.
Lori Bedecon on how Canadian design translates to the rest of the world.
Here's the thing, there's a lot of Canadian designers working abroad that do design and that are well known, but not a lot of them do Canadian design per se. So when we started this, that was the goal. We really wanted to do a Canadian, bring on a Canadian design perspective and to make the pieces that would be presented to people, even though they have their roots in Canadian heritage or crafts, they could be put anywhere and anybody could relate to it. And we've had really surprising feedback from that. The Mountie bar stool, the weaving technique. When we were in Milan in 2008, that was the first time we presented it. People were walking around and mostly from northern Italy, and they commented that the weaving technique and the material reminded them of something their grandparents used to have that disappeared after the revolution, the industrial period came about. So it's really, you know, for them it was like, oh wait, we had this also. I can relate to this piece. There's ways of presenting it that people could relate to it, even though it's called Mountie, it's bright orange, and it has rawhide. You know, it is quintessentially Canadian.
That about sums up the IDS, an international design fair with a quintessentially Canadian vibe to it, from the beer-based cocktails, the wood-paneling furniture, to the snow and ice on the streets outside. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Mar Sellers.
Thank you very much for that, Mar. And we're joined now in the studio by Marcus Hippie, Monocle's producer / presenter, who was in Toronto last week as well. Thank you for coming in, Marcus.
Hello. It's nice to be back in the studio.
Now, Toronto is not a city maybe that people associate with design, but you were there. It seemed that the design folk weren't confined to the trade halls themselves, but actually there were quite a few things on the streets as well. Tell me a little bit about what you saw.
There was a lot of things happening over there. I went to some events that were a part of Toronto Offsite Design Festival, and maybe the most impressive thing I found was this hotel. I walked into the hotel, and actually, besides the hotel being in normal use, on the corridors, in the lounges, everywhere, there was an exhibition of, you know, by young designers.
Very nice. And this wasn't just hotel furniture that you thought might be an exhibition. It was a proper exhibition
It was a proper exhibition.
And Toronto
it was,
Design Week.
There was a lot of young talent over there, and I kind of walked around carrying my Monocle tote bag. And actually, you know, I have to say that what was really funny about there is that everyone noticed that. They all wanted to come and talk to me. So, Hugo, I feel like you should have been there.
Well, I'm very glad that you were there. And you generously whipped out your microphone and canvassed a few opinions about the state of Canadian design and sort of Toronto's design scene for us. We're going to listen to some of those now.
My name is Pamela Matharu, and I am the co-founder of Come Up to My Room and co-curator of this year's 10th anniversary edition of Come Up to My Room, the Gladstone Hotel's alternative design event. I think what excites me the most in this city is new innovative thinkers who are bringing together traditional practices and contemporary practices and creating new dialogues with design.
My name is Julian. I'm a student and also an art director. There's a lot of handmade stuff coming out of Toronto now. It's all very trendy. And yeah, they're taking a lot of influence from vintage finds, you know, typographically speaking, and just design-wise.
My name is Sherry Dubeau. I'm a graphic designer as well and student at George Brown College. It's just interesting to see that in Toronto. Like, I feel like it's up and coming. It's more of an up and coming city. Like, we're still trying to find ourselves. The design community is still growing, and I feel like there's other places out there that are more established, but I think we're rising as a design city.
My name is Tor McGlade. I currently work at Quadrangle Architects. Toronto currently is about pushing the boundaries of adaptive reuse, I find, and modern ways of doing things. So there's a couple of guys, actually have a show here, who have reinvented the propane canister into light fixtures. You know, so we're all about looking to the past, adapting what is there, and then making it modern and interesting and current.
Noah Bronstein, and I'm the director of exhibitions at the Gladstone Hotel. There's a lot of emerging talents that are getting the attention that they deserve, which I think is really exciting. I think that's a really supportive city for emerging designers and artists. And there's someone in particular in this exhibition, Thomas Rozic, who does lighting pieces that are really beautiful, very simplistic, but just amazing. The execution is just perfection. And so I'm really excited because he's gotten a lot of press coverage and there's a lot of support behind him. And so I think it's nice that emerging practitioners are getting that kind of platform from the community and they're being embraced by the public.
My name's Aidan Mitchellmore and my partner's name is Andrew Ashbury, and we're students at the University of Waterloo School of Architecture in fourth year. I think Toronto has a lot to offer in the design scene, and I think thinking about design not as something fashionable but something that is really not caught up in fashion and something that actually works towards a better understanding or a new realization. So like a lot of familiar ideas or methods that are being reused in new ways, like Tara's installation, which uses origami but manages to find a new way to reuse it and make an experience out of it, and using familiar geometries as a way to come up with new ideas and not necessarily being drawn out by fashionable trends but finding lasting type of design solutions. I'm really excited about the future of where the Toronto design industry is going, because it's growing really quickly, I'd say.
I'm quite excited about the fact that we're starting to, as a city, make our a name of ourselves as a design center. For a long time, Toronto has had a lot of local strong talent, but we've been very quiet. We don't push ourselves. And I think we're getting a name for ourselves outside of the city and outside of the country. And to me, that's the most exciting point, because I've moved back to Toronto at a really exciting time.
And there you go. Toronto is clearly home to a thriving design community. I'll be heading there myself in a few weeks to bring you more news from the makers and retailers there. And with any luck, it will have warmed up a little by then. But for this week, that's all we have time for on Section D. Next week, we'll be donning our mortarboards to attend the inaugural design conference at Harvard University, and we'll sit down with Alessandro Benetton too. This week's show was produced by Alad John and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out, here's a brilliant young group from Toronto. This is Broken Social Scene with Forced to Love. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. Yeah, we're forced to love.